This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran holds a ceremony to launch the clinical trial of its second domestically made coronavirus vaccine. Tehran tells the UN that Israel has recently intensified its provocative remarks against Iran, warning it will give a firm response to any military adventures. Palestinian rights groups calling for swift action after the International Criminal Court ruled that it has jurisdiction to probe Israeli war crimes. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Starting with news in Iran, medical experts have started a clinical trial of another indigenously developed coronavirus vaccine. Covapars is an inhalable vaccine developed using biotechnology. The tests have already been conducted successfully on animals, including guinea pigs, hamsters, and monkeys. The Covapars vaccine has been developed by the Razi Institute. That's one of the most important medical research centers in West Asia. The launch of its human trial was announced in a ceremony in Tehran that was attended by experts and officials. Addressing the gathering, Health Minister Saeed Namaki said that achievement is a source of national pride.
One of the major jobs done over the past few months was to rely on domestically developed technology to produce a vaccine. The COVID-19 vaccine is not a simple one to develop, as the virus, as the COVID-19 virus is a complex one. Producing a vaccine for it is a very complex process.
Well, the minister added it's not clear how effective the coronavirus vaccines developed by different countries are, but they are the only way to available to help contain the disease. Iran has developed another COVID-19 jab called Coviran, which is under the first human trial phase. Volunteers who received the shot had no symptoms such as shocks or fever after the injection. Masoud Soleimani, a vaccine trials expert at the Iran University of Medical Sciences, has provided us with some detail on the development process of the new Iranian COVID vaccine.
So they created the vaccine about in March last year, end of February, March last year. And then from March, they started the animal testing first on mouse and hamster and rabbit, and then by almost end of May, start of June, they started testing it on monkeys. The green African monkey, which is very close to human race, they started testing on that monkey. And since then until now, we have about 10 months of data, which shows that this vaccine is safe, created no harm on these 23 monkeys that right now they are alive and well. And also they created a long-standing immune response, which what we need in an effective vaccine. Today, we had basically announcement of the start of the human phase of this vaccine. One of the innovations in this vaccine is that it consists of another third dose. The first dose is when you is in the form of inoculation. So the second, it comes about 3 weeks after the first dose. Again, it's an injection. And then it comes a month later, comes the nasal spray, which is an innovation, as I said, in this vaccine, because we have studies that shows that if the nasal IgA immune response becomes activated, then the person will not be spread the virus. Because one of the problems is that when you are immune against the virus, you don't get the virus, you are immune, you are healthy, but you may still spread the virus from nasal secretion.
COVID-19 clusters on U.S. military bases in South Korea, raising alarm with the country's public and activists. Many worry the virus is being spread from U.S. service members to the general South Korean population. Frank Smith has a report.
U.S. military personnel deploying from the American mainland to bases abroad are bringing COVID-19 with them. In South Korea, more than 700 United States Forces Korea members have tested positive for the virus, raising alarms in South Korea.
Since Americans value individual freedom and personal liberty, they have tendencies to not adhere to South Korean quarantine guidelines. Therefore, in the case of Pyeongtaek, living with the U.S. military, there is a high risk of exposure to coronavirus.
U.S. Forces Korea soldiers have repeatedly flouted local COVID-19 precautions, including holding a large maskless party. In January, U.S. bases here issued shelter-in-place orders because of COVID-19 cluster outbreaks.
The U.S. Forces Korea Camp Humphreys said in a February 1st press release that less than 1% of its active duty troops had tested positive for COVID-19. If we compare that to how South Korea is dealing with the virus, it's 10 times more likely for a U.S. soldier on a military base here to have COVID-19 than someone in the general South Korean population.
U.S. forces here have begun administering the vaccine, although new cases continue to arrive on almost a daily basis.
It seems that it is necessary to thoroughly manage corona-confirmed patients through testing before entering Korea, and more thorough management measures should be implemented not only for the U.S. military, but also for South Korean employees on the U.S. base who have a lot of contact with people.
Meanwhile, South Korea continues to experience hundreds of new cases each day, with the rollout of a vaccine set to begin here this month. Frank Smith, Pyeongtaek, South Korea.
Well, the COVID-19 crisis deepening in the Americas region despite efforts to contain the virus and its variants through vaccination and restrictive measures. Some 462,000 Americans have died since the first fatality was reported a year ago. On Friday, the U.S. set a new record in daily fatalities with more than 5,000 deaths. The country's confirmed cases are approaching 27 million. Despite attempts to curb the surge in corona figures, the U.S. remains the world's worst hit country in terms of both cases and deaths. Now, in Brazil, the deaths have surpassed 231,000, the second highest death toll worldwide. Officials registered some 1,000 new fatalities on Saturday. They also recorded more than 50,000 cases of the virus, raising the total to 9.5. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has warned that Iran will give a firm response to any Israeli military adventurism. Majid Taftabanch issued the warning, a letter to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and the President of the Security Council. Taftabanch said that Israel has recently intensified its provocative and hawkish remarks against Iran and is planning to carry out the hostile threats. He described those threats as a blatant violation of the UN Charter. The Iranian envoy demanded an international response to quote Israel's destabilizing policies in the region. In January, Israeli Army Chief of Staff warned the U.S. against rejoining the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Aviv Kochavi said that he had ordered his forces to gear up for a possible offensive against Iran. Several Palestinian rights groups have praised the International Criminal Court for its decision to launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes in the occupied territories. In a joint statement, the groups, including Al-Haq, Al-Mezan Center for Human Rights, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, called the ICC ruling a landmark decision. They stressed that immediate action be taken by the court to ensure justice and accountability for Palestinian victims. The ICC ruling says it has jurisdiction to investigate the situation in the Palestinian territories occupied by Israel in 1967. Well, that means that the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, are goods. The Israeli Prime Minister has rejected the ruling, calling it pure anti-Semitism. The Palestinian leadership has welcomed the decision by the ICC, clearing the way for its chief prosecutor to open a war crimes probe into Israeli military actions committed on Palestinian land. Mona Kendil reports from the West Bank.
The Palestinian leadership has praised the International Criminal Court for its ruling that it has jurisdiction in the Palestinian territories, allowing its chief prosecutor, Fatou Ben Souda, to investigate Israeli atrocities, despite fierce objections from Tel Aviv. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Ishtayi said the decision is a victory for justice, humanity, and freedom, and for the blood of the victims, namely the Palestinians and their families. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also praised the ruling and said it's ready to cooperate with the ICC's prosecutor if an investigation is launched.
We urge the International Court and its chief prosecutor to immediately launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes against the Palestinian people. We have already filed several legal complaints against Israel with the ICC. We are now ready to carry out every possible effort to see Israeli military officials and settlers being prosecuted for their crimes.
The ICC's ruling, however, has angered the Israeli regime, as its Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, dismissed the ruling as a political tribunal, accusing the ICC for being a political body and not a legal institution. Israel has not joined the International Criminal Court, but the Palestinian Authority is a signatory since 2015. This means the ICC's mandate is to prosecute people, not countries, including those from states that are not signatories, and in this case, Israeli leaders, military officials, and soldiers who are accused of carrying out crimes against Palestinians.
I doubt that that will make such a difference in Israel, because if we know the nature of Israel and it's based on violence, based on the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people and grabbing the land of Palestine, because of that, I don't think that will make a big difference for the Israeli policies in the region.
The Palestinians have asked the court to look into Israeli crimes during its 2014 war against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as Israel's construction of illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. The ICC's decision paves the way for the tribunal's prosecutor to open a war crime investigation. But the main question lingering in mind is that will the U.S., which has furiously condemned the court, allow prosecution of Israeli officials and forces over their crimes committed in the Palestinian territories? Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Author and researcher Christoph Oberlin has hailed the ICC decision to investigate the Israeli war crimes against Palestinians. Oberlin has written a book. It's called Path to Court, Israeli Leaders Before the International Criminal Court. He says the decision opens a window to bring the perpetrators to justice.
The ICC, the sanctions, are directed to the responsibles. And the responsible are not only the soldiers. There is a war crime. And everybody has to know that the real responsible are the people who are planning. And so that doesn't prevent the political responsible. They are the first responsible. That means that the Prime Minister, Netanyahu, for instance, is responsible for the victims of the March of Return or the War of 2014. Israel is not a member of the ICC. That doesn't prevent Israel to be condemned or to be investigated. You never ask to criminal to recognize the court. It is absolutely stupid to say that. They have to receive proofs. Exactly like there is a murder, you have to be absolutely sure who is the killer, who has killed the people, how he did it, and so on. So you have different files. The file about the March of Return, you have now, the ICC received a few months ago, 2,400 private complaints of persons, victims, or family of victims, and for each complaint, they have the chain of proof with the video, with the autopsy, with the witness of the crime and everything, the report of the doctors and the identity of the witness. Everything has been translated into English, so it has been a lot of work. And in fact, there is a very professional team in Gaza working. They start to work after the World War 14 because the authorities became conscious that it was absolutely necessary to bring directly to the ICC the chain of proof, because it is absolutely sure that Israel will block the investigators, the policers, the police of the ICC to investigate on the field.
In other news, Iran saying a newly declared U.S. decision to end its military support for the Saudi-led war coalition is not enough to end the six-year war on Yemen. The Iranian foreign ministry says the Saudi-led air, sea, and land blockade of Yemen and attacks on the country must end as well. The ministry's spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, says that ending support for and not selling weapons to Riyadh can be a step toward correcting past mistakes. Express hope that warmongering states would realize their strategic mistakes in invading Yemen and admit to their mistakes. On Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that Washington will terminate all offensive support to Saudi Arabia in the Yemen conflict, including related arms sales. A political commentator, Brian Terrell, says that perpetrators of the Yemen war should be brought to justice and that the United States needs to end its airstrikes on that country.
The blockade will continue. There has to be something more. A year ago, the United Nations group of eminent experts on Yemen suggested that the situation turned over to the criminal court. And it's not the International Criminal Court. And it simply is not enough for one of the suppliers to perhaps cut back on the weapons. And we don't know how that's even going to turn out. There needs to be, you know, crimes have been committed and reparations have to be paid for the United States simply to say that it's going to stop selling the relevant, you know, stop the relevant arms sales to Saudi Arabia is not enough. There's also been, since 2002, the United States has had its own war in Yemen against Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. This has been very destabilizing for Yemen, and unfortunately, this war that the United States war in Yemen is not even being addressed by this.
Well, speaking of Yemen, the Ansarullah movement there has welcomed the U.S. decision to delist the group as a designated terror entity. An advisor to the Yemeni head of the Supreme Political Council said that the new U.S. administration got off to a good start and took an advanced step toward peace. He, however, noted the credibility of Washington's steps will only be assessed when the Saudi-led war ends and the siege is lifted. Member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Ali Houthi, also said that his country is ready for both war and peace. On that effort, Washington said that Congress has been formally notified of State Secretary Antony Blinken's intent to reverse the terrorist designation of Ansarullah. Former President Donald Trump blacklisted the Yemeni movement only days before leaving office. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of Parstoday. My dad, who is from India,
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, February 7th, 2021. I'm Atefeh Irfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails and letters. So contact us and tell us what you think about our programs. Or if you have any messages for our dear listeners around the world, then record your voice and send it to us and get your voice heard. Remember, dear listeners, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. February 10th marks the 42nd anniversary of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. This victory ended a generation of U.S.-installed tyranny that deprived Iranians of their fundamental rights. Iran regained control over its sovereign independence and natural resources, and the U.S. no longer able to plunder them. For Iran and its people, there is no turning back to control by a repressive foreign power and its installed puppet regime. The victory of the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic Revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and the 20th century. The victory of the Islamic Revolution has had deep impact on different aspects of the Iranian people's life. This revolution enjoys characteristics and principles that have their roots in Islam. Characteristics like self-sacrifice, justice, and a struggle against oppression. So, congratulations on the 42nd anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution to all freedom-seeking and justice-seeking people around the world. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very useful and important to us in IRIB English Radio, especially to our technicians and engineers. As you may know, these reception reports enable us to provide a better service to our dear listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving a QSL card from us. However, these days, with the outbreak of coronavirus pandemic around the world, please don't expect a QSL card from IRIB English Radio. As you may know, sending any material on behalf of our radio is temporarily halted due to the pandemic. So please be patient until the disease is controlled around the world. Then we in IRB English Radio can get back on track and send you the souvenirs of our radio and also QSL cards. And here, I truly appreciate those of our dear listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Toshio Shibata from Japan, Konstantin Luzgin from Russia, and Rafiqul Islam from Bangladesh. Toshio, Konstantin, and Rafiqul Islam, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. And a million thanks to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us emails and letters. Most of them are actually congratulation message on the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, which I mentioned some of their names here, and later during our program, I will read their emails and letters. Here we have an email from Hey Mercia from the Philippines, one of our regular listeners. Also, we have an email from Toshio Shibata from Japan. Mr. Jayant Chakrabarty from India has also sent us an email. From Italy, we have an email from Pastorino Gianni. And from Tausif Abbas from Pakistan has also sent us an email. Thanks a lot, dear listeners. After a short break, I will be back with all these kind messages. Welcome back. First of all, we have an email from Hey Mercia from the Philippines. Hey Mercia is, as I said, is one of our regular listeners who says, Dear IRIB, I would like to congratulate a happy 42nd anniversary of 1979 revolution. I would say that the revolution was a prelude of something big to happen for the next decades. I'm so glad that Iran, after 1979 revolution, no longer suffered from the U.S. imperialism and a corrupt regime. First of all, salam and greetings to you, Hey Mercia, from the Philippines, and thank you very much for writing this congratulation message to IRIB English Radio. Yes, in 1979, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians got rid of U.S. imperialism and any dependency, and the victory of this revolution became the source of inspiration for all freedom-seeking and justice-seeking people and countries around the world. So, congratulations on the 42nd anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution to all freedom-seeking and justice-seeking people around the world. Thank you again, Hey Mercia from the Philippines. Write to us soon. We wish you all the best. Also, from Japan, we have an email from Toshio Shibata. Toshio Shibata says, Hello, dear friends at IRIB English Radio. I would like to send you a report on the reception of medium wave broadcast here in Tokyo, Japan. Could you please check the report and the recording and let me know if it was IRIB broadcast? Best regards and take care. Salam and greetings to you, Toshio Shibata from Japan, and lots of gratitude for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. It seems to me that you've already joined IRIB English Radio listeners. Welcome. Yes, we received the report and the recording, and so please accept our deepest thanks for them. Toshio Shibata from Japan, please tell us which programs you like the best. Tell us your views about IRIB English Radio broadcast. We're looking forward to hearing from you very soon in the future. Thanks again, Toshio Shibata from Japan. Dear friends, after a short break, I will be back with other emails and letters from around the world. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Jayanta Chakraborty from India, one of our regular listeners, has sent us a congratulations message on the victory of 1979 revolution, Islamic revolution of Iran. And this is such a long letter, actually email. Jayanta Chakraborty from India says, the 1979 revolution has been a watershed event, not only for the proud and heroic Iranian people, but also a glorious chapter in the annals of world history. The Iranians had showed the world that a determination can take on the mightiest forces of imperialism and exploitation for consolidating its national interest and honor. The opportunist West has always been after Iran's rich oil resources, so they had supported a puppet autocratic monarchy of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi to serve their nefarious goals. However, the alert Iranians, led by their charismatic leader, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, with popular support from the students, men and women, thwarted these evil designs and fought successfully for safeguarding national sovereignty and independence. This dramatic event of 1979 shook the world and ushered the birth of the Islamic Republic, voted by a national referendum. After passing through 42 years of glorious achievements in different vital sectors, Iran has taken its rightful place in the Committee of Nations. It is a strong nation and has a strong voice to be heard by the rest of the world. However, as Iranians celebrate this happy occasion, they should not be complacent. Danger still lurks from many quarters to destabilize and derail the fruits of development achieved since the advent of the revolution. Economic sanctions have been imposed to impede the country's development. However, the world today respects a strong Iran that is fully capable to defend itself from any external aggression. The revolution has paved the way for pragmatic and progressive ideas leading to a profound change in the life of its citizens. The revolution of 1979 has taught the Iranians to support and defend the oppressive people of the world and to uphold and promote international law of peace and justice. Salam and greetings to you, Jayanta Chakraborty from India, and please accept our warmest and deepest thanks for writing such a thoughtful and great email to IRIB English Radio. Yes, the victory of Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 ended a generation of U.S.-installed tyranny that deprived Iranians of their fundamental rights. Iran regained control over its sovereign independence and natural resources, the U.S. no longer able to plunder them. For Iran and its people, there is no turning back to control by a repressive foreign power and its installed puppet regime. Iranian sovereign independence threatens U.S. imperial interests by encouraging and inspiring other nations under its yoke to break free. Jayanta Chakraborty from India, again, thank you for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. We're looking forward to hearing from you soon, and congratulations on the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran to all justice-seeking and freedom-seeking people around the world. Dear listeners, after a short break, I will be back with other emails and letters and congratulation messages from around the world. Please stay tuned. Welcome back. From Pakistan, we have an email from Tawseef Abbas. Tawseef Abbas says, greetings and congratulations on the occasion of the 42nd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Iran to you all. What impresses me about your revolution is that how one individual changed the whole dynamics of the West Asia region and the world in general. How selflessness of the leader can achieve such a success and can result in ousting of dictators and oppressors. The outstanding features of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, in my opinion, were selflessness, the vision, the spirituality, the humbleness to others, kindness, and many other virtues. Salam, Tawseef Abbas from Pakistan, and warm thanks to you for writing such a thoughtful message to IRIB English Radio. And again, congratulations on the 42nd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution to all justice and freedom-seeking people from around the world. Thank you again for writing this congratulation message to IRIB English Radio. We wish you all the best. Write to us soon. Tawseef Abbas from Pakistan. Also from Italy, we have an email from Pastorino Gianni from Italy. Pastorino Gianni from Italy says, greetings from Andorra, Italy. I'm receiving with great pleasure your program. I would be happy to receive your QSL card. Thank you in advance and best regards. Salam and ciao, Pastorino Gianni from Italy. And I do express my appreciation to you for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. We are glad that you're satisfied with IRIB English Radio broadcast. As you said, you're receiving it with pleasure. We're so committed, we in IRIB English Radio, we are so committed to our role in providing the best quality of programs and broadcasts to our dear listeners around the world. Thank you again, Pastorino Gianni from Italy, for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. Write to us soon. Dear listeners, time tells me we have to skip to the next part of our program, that is today's interview, which is conducted with one of our dear listeners. Stay tuned.
Well, my name is Christopher Lewis. I live in the United Kingdom, in the West Midlands in England. My hobbies include, of course, shortwave listening and listening to other broadcasts from different parts of the world. I also enjoy reading and growing vegetables, gardening, all these different hobbies. And I have to say that shortwave listening is probably my best out of all of these. But in general, I've been reading about the Islamic Revolution quite in depth over the past couple of years. I'm still absorbing lots of information about it. And I'd just like to read some of my personal impressions that I've gathered from reading various sources on the internet and also from books. Basically, the revolution created high moral values in Iranian society. It created a sense of self-respect, and it's also an example to other nations of how society can live together peacefully. The revolution also represented the Iranian ideals and brought them forward. It was also a protest against ancient imperialistic influences as well. And going further on, it also created and brought forward Iran's freedom from oppressive regimes. And it also is an inspiration to a lot of people around the world who are repressed. It also shows the world and proves to the world that Iran, of course, is not dependent on any other nations for its survival. And Imam Khomeini brought into reality all that the Iranian people had hoped for. It's created Iran as a well-functioning nation and has also enabled the founding of good relations with many nations around the world who value the same high moral standards. And I think that it's most important that we create sound understanding of each other's cultures and also improve education about culture, expanding any myths and misunderstanding that can be created by the most part by mass media. Well, I think from my point of view, and people of similar thinking, that the Iranian revolution has proved that you don't have to be bossed around by any other organization, you don't have to be told how to live. It's sort of like a shining beacon to peoples, you know, around the world, not just in Europe, but in other countries of the world. It's proved that it's a strong power, and it's a sovereign nation. It's it's just very, very encouraging.
And here we wrap up this week's edition of Listener's Special. Keep in touch and have a good time.
Listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Kashmir is one of the most beautiful regions in the world, but continues to be in crisis. Now, the region has had an uncertain future since 1947. With the partition of India, both Pakistan and India have claimed the area, as well as a smaller part by China, and the United Nations ruled that a plebiscite must be carried out. However, New Delhi has refused to allow the region to vote, and 18 months ago, India tightened its grip on Kashmir, revoking Article 370, which had given the region semi-autonomy. And the situation continues to deteriorate and be unresolved. Stay with us as we take a look at the latest in the region of Kashmir on this debate.
These people are marching on the streets to show support to the people of Kashmir. This rally in Islamabad is part of a series of events in Pakistan organized to mark the Kashmir Solidarity Day. Pakistan observes the day every year on the 5th of February. Pakistan's foreign minister led the rally in Islamabad and urged the international community to play a role in ending the suffering of the people of Kashmir.
The purpose of our today's rally is to express solidarity with the people of Kashmir. The people of Kashmir have been under siege for the last 18 months. but we want to make it clear that India cannot suppress the freedom of Kashmir forever.
Kashmir has remained under lockdown since August 5, 2019, when India revoked its special status. Thousands of people have been detained, and over 8 million Kashmiris have little access to the outside world.
We are thankful to the people of Pakistan and the government for supporting us. We are hopeful that Pakistan would continue to support us till Kashmir is liberated from India.
We must understand as the Kashmiris are living under an occupation and oppression for the past 73 years. And the 5th of February marks a day where we, the people of Pakistan particularly, tell the Kashmiris living across the line of control that they are not alone.
Pakistan and India have competing claims on the long-standing Jammu and Kashmir issue. Both claim the region in full but rule on parts of it. They have fought wars over Kashmir, where tensions continue to increase. There is a fear of yet another conflict on the dispute between the two neighbors. The country's prime minister visited the Pakistani-administered Kashmir to mark the day.
Prime Minister Imran Khan says Pakistan is ready to take two steps forward if India is willing to seek a political settlement of the long-standing Kashmir dispute. However, given the current hostilities between the two neighbors, experts believe there is a slim chance of any dialogue on Kashmir, at least in the near future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Mr. Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and Kashmir Institute for International Affairs, Muzammil Ayub Thakir, President of the World Kashmir Freedom Movement out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in Toronto, and Zafar, why do you think that in August of 2019, India revoked the limited autonomy that it had given the region? What was the goal of that?
Well, ever since the current regime in India came to power under Narendra Modi, he follows a very extremist, racist ideology of Hindutva, which basically negates the rights of all minorities, even inside India, let alone in Kashmir. And Kashmir, of course, as in the introduction it was pointed out, had enjoyed special status since the Indian forces illegally occupied it in October of 1947. We need to step back a little bit and understand that according to the partition plan of 1947, Muslim majority areas were to constitute the state of Pakistan and Hindu majority areas were to go with India. Now, Kashmir was and remains a Muslim majority area, but it had a Hindu ruler. And regrettably, while the people of Kashmir wanted to become part of Pakistan, the ruler, through a sleight of hand, what is referred to as the instrument of accession, it was a temporary measure. He went with India, but India pledged at that time that the wishes of the people would be respected. There are 11 Security Council resolutions that call for a referendum in Kashmir. Initially, India promised that it would abide by those resolutions. Now it has backed out of it. And because India feels that it is militarily more powerful, it has a Hindu nationalist government in power, that they do not recognize the rights of the Kashmiri people. And we see this crisis that intensified on August the 5th of 2019.
Well, Muzammil, what do you think, what does India want by pressuring this region? As the guests in Toronto said, that region is a majority Muslim region with the various declarations from the United Nations and saying that they should be able to vote on their status, whether they want to be a part of Pakistan or India or independent. But India isn't allowing that. What is India after exactly by what it's doing?
It's a very good question. I think we need to, it's something that your guest touched upon. It's a neo-colonial imperialist expansionist program of settler colonialism and demographic change. That's exactly what India wants to do. And if these terms sound familiar, that's because it is familiar. It's exactly what the Nazis had suggested and what they talked about when they performed the Holocaust and when they were against the Jews. And these people, the RSS, the BJP is backed by the RSS. The RSS is a parent organization, designated terrorist organization in the past. It was even banned in India in the 40s and in the late 40s. It's the same organization that took responsibility for the killing of Mohandas, or rather what other people call Mahatma Gandhi. So you understand what kind of organization this is, and their entire agenda, which they openly accept, is an expansionist program. They openly admire Hitler. They openly claim to take direction from the Nazi Germany handbook. And their entire agenda is Akhand Bharat. The term they use is Akhand Bharat, a pan-Hindu nation, one party, one nation, one ideology. And that's exactly what they want to do. And there's so much proof of this in their own literature and in the media that exists in India. The BJP has become a reason for fanaticism. It's easier to radicalize people in India because of the lack of literacy and the lack of information that exists, and the fact that they are not as quite well-informed as the rest of the international counterparts, so they are easily more radicalized, the same way exactly how the Germans did under the Nazis. So we have to recognize exactly what they want to do and why they're doing it. Kashmir is part of the bigger program. After Kashmir, they started tampering with the CAA and the NRC bills. These are citizen amendmentship acts in India, basically discriminatory acts against Muslims and minorities. That's right after they meddled with Article 370 and 35A, revoking the special status of Kashmir. And now we're seeing the farmers' protests as well. So it's not historical agendas or assumptions of what's going to happen. These are happening in real time right now. And one simple example that I want to give is how the Indian government, particularly the BJP, the RSS, they term some of these locations. So, for example, Mecca, the Holy Kaaba in Mecca, they don't call it Mecca, they call it Makeshwar Mahadev Temple. I mean, this is what I mean when I talk about expansionist programs to create a pan-Hindu nation.
Well, Zafar, if you agree with our guest in London, why is there such silence from the international community? Because if it's true what he said, our analyst said, and that there is a racist agenda behind this, and of course the type of abuse that the Indian government is being accused of inflicting on the Kashmir region, why aren't we hearing more from the so-called international agencies?
Well, this has to do with the geostrategic interests of various powers. Right now, what we see is that the United States is targeting China because China is an emerging economic and military power, and China has also expanded its geostrategic reach into the Central Asian and the broader Eurasian landmass. And of course, Pakistan is closely aligned with China, whereas the United States and its Western allies are using India to target China and to frustrate China's plans. So you would see not only what India is doing, the atrocities and the crimes that India is perpetrating in Kashmir, as well as in the rest of India, incidentally, as Muzamil pointed out, that the Muslims are being targeted. They constitute 185 million people in India, but these draconian laws, the Citizenship Amendment Act and other acts that they have introduced, and the Hindu Nazis are openly declaring that India is only, if people want to stay here, they can only stay here as Hindus, not as any other religion. So not just Muslims, but even Christians are being targeted, but the rest of the world is remaining silent because they want to use India for their geostrategic purposes, and so they overlook it. Now, if you go beyond India, you look at the Zionist state of Israel, whose policy, of course, India is following to the letter. Again, the atrocities that the Zionists perpetrate against the Palestinian people are not really addressed because Zionist Israel is seen as a beachhead in the Muslim world that is used by the West, particularly now, of course, the United States, that uses Israel to, in fact, keep that entire region destabilized. So what we are seeing is a geostrategic chess game that is going on, in which the United States want to checkmate China, and of course, beyond that, Russia, and they see India as a a partner with them. Mm-hmm. Although I want to point out that the West is going to be greatly disappointed. India will not be able to fulfill the desires of the West because China definitely is emerging. It's march towards economic development, and its military power cannot be checked. Of course, China is not going to be a rival to the United States militarily within the next maybe 5 to 10 years, but beyond that, it will be. But economically, there are already World Bank studies, IMF studies, and other studies that indicate that China is, in fact, going to supersede the United States economically by the year 2028. So it is in order to undermine China's rise that the rest of the world is remaining silent to the gross atrocities and crimes that the Indian regime is perpetrating. But I just also want to add one more point,
mm-hmm.
that while it may be able to get away with it for now, I think the way history works and operates is that criminals are ultimately brought to justice. We saw yesterday the International Criminal Court in The Hague actually ruled that it has jurisdiction to investigate Israeli war crimes,
right,
in Gaza as well as in the West Bank and Jerusalem, etc. So I think it's a warning that the Indian rulers should take heed of, because a day will come, a day of reckoning, when their crimes will also be brought to trial, and
okay.
these Indian rulers will be held accountable.
Okay. Your thoughts, Mozambique, because as Zafar said, a day is reckoning is near, but also in his analysis of things, especially with the part that it's a chess game by the United States, by the West, and trying to limit China and also Russia. If that is the case, it appears that the situation is going to deteriorate before getting better in Kashmir. How do you see it?
Well, it's pretty accurate. We've seen the lockdown, obviously the conventional lockdown that we've seen because of COVID, and people's understandings or starting to understand what exactly COVID means and what exactly a lockdown means. In Kashmir, this is a completely different situation. It's been much, much worse. Deaths, rapes, enforced disappearances, human shields. I mean, it's a huge list of war crimes that India commits inside occupied Kashmir, and it's been exponentially growing. And now we've seen measures where they are issuing domicile certificates to non-residents, essentially changing the demography of the area. And once that happens, the indigenous people will no longer have a place to stay. We've seen this with the Rohingya. We're seeing this with the Palestinians. And this is exactly what happens when a settler colonial empire, somebody that wants to be an empire, these are the kind of tactics they use. In terms of the larger scheme of things, there is an implosion within India at this moment, particularly after the Article 370 and 35A being revoked, but also the CAA and the NRC. And I keep on referring back to this because the minorities started to stand up. They finally understood what the Kashmiris were talking about when we said that if you don't stand up for us today, tomorrow they're going to come for you. And even then, that kind of slow process of protesting and trying to vilify the BJP government, it still didn't quite take as much, it didn't pick up as much pace as it should have until the farmers' protest happened. And that has been a big stumbling block for the Indian government, where it seems like potentially that they may need to retract that position. But ultimately, what needs to happen is, as Mr. Bangash said, is that the world powers need to somehow intervene. But until and unless they recognize India as the emerging power, they want to sponsor India as the emerging power in that area, we won't see much development and much change. We've recently, of course, seen the Chinese incursion into Ladakh, claiming that territory for their own, essentially putting up a fight against the Indians. And we haven't really seen much of a reaction from the Indian government, mainly because they can't really push back against a formidable foe. But in that sense, the situation in Kashmir will exponentially get worse, and that is expected. But ultimately, what we're expecting, people like myself from Indian-occupied Kashmir, we're expecting that the international community does intervene, the ICJ does intervene, that the United Nations observers at least go into Kashmir, because they're able to go into the Pakistani side of Kashmir and have unfettered access. Whereas in Indian-occupied Kashmir, that just doesn't happen. And of course, we know about Amnesty International being banned from India for reporting on Kashmir, and there are many other organizations as well. So we do, I mean,